Okay, I hope that you have your body moving. Okay, all of the people saying they're feeling hot. Are you feeling hot? This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. You're just listening to the mighty Arrow, Adolphus Celestine Edmund Cassell, also known as Arrow, with Hot, Hot, Hot. That was a song that was appropriated by Buster Poindexter and made very, very popular, but it actually came out of Arrow from Montserrat in the Caribbean. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And, of course, you know what the deal is. It is Friday, and it's time to free your mind. So let's get to it. 888-874-4888. Let's hear what's on your mind. A lot of stories to consider, but that's your call today. You define what the stories are and what it is you want to say about those stories. 888-874-4888. Very, very interesting reactions I've gotten all week to the programs that we had this week, and apparently they will continue to stimulate discussion. And there are stories we didn't get to, but again, we can't do everything, but we do what is important and what basically helps us along in making sense of our environment. So much goes on in the news, you know, you just can't carry all of the news at the same time. So we'll see what's going on. Hello, Sarah. You're on the air.
Greetings, Eutrice.
Hello.
Well, Eutrice, let me say I enjoyed your program all of this week. It was most informative.
Thank you.
And, yes, ma'am. And I'd like to thank the NPR staff and also greetings to the NPR listeners out there. And I hope we all have a wonderful weekend and we are not feeling hot, hot, hot. But
it's hot, hot, hot where I am. That's for sure.
I'm sure you're part of the country. Of course, it's always hot out there, but, you know, it was nice to have the little rhythm going. You kind of put me in mind to crop over. So it's going to be very, very enjoyable, Eutrice.
Thank you.
You are so welcome. You need to play some Kitchener when you get a chance.
He's next. He's up next. Go around from the Caribbean, we have Kitchener, definitely.
Yes, ma'am. But what I wanted to free my mind on today, Eutrice, is this, the situation with this rancher in Nevada and the standoff that he had with the Bureau of Land Management on this cattle that they had confiscated because he was grazing it on property that was not his. And I listened to various shows, and they were giving their various views at one. A lot of people were saying, oh, he was right. He is being, the government has been encroaching too much, and it's about time somebody stand up to the government and not let them overrun them. But what a lot of people are not failing to see the point is that here it is, this man, he is sitting on land that he said he's been on since back in the 1800s when he moved from Utah, because he's a Mormon, moved out there to Nevada. And he's been on this land. Now, how did he get this land? Where did this land come from? Because we always like to say that they have a right to land and this and that. But you always have to trace this land back to the original source. How did you get the land? How did you acquire this land? Because it was not a clean transaction. No Native American did not give clean title to anyone for this land. Because if we were to look at the whole southwestern half of the United States, including the state of Texas, where I'm in, New Mexico, Colorado, all the way across to California, you would see all of that at one time or the other belongs to the Republic of Mexico. And it was gotten as a result of the United States getting into a fight with the Mexicans and taking territory from them to put it out here. So whenever they always want to say that we want to put up fences, we want these people to go back to where they come from, this is not your country because this is territory that you have stolen from another people, including territories that were taken from the Native Americans who were here. And these invaders, they came over here and they took these land and property and cattle and everything from these people, and they have it. Now, here it is that he wants to graze his cattle. He don't want to pay for the grazing rights. The government says, okay, we're going to take, even though they're both wrong, because he is wrong and the government is wrong, because the government is controlling property that's not even theirs, because did that come from a clean transaction? But here it is, we have two bunch of criminals standing off against each other. But this man, he decided all the posse, everybody from all around the country, grabbed the AK-47s and the AR-16s and decided to rush to his aid because we can do a standoff or shootout with the government because they have been taking this man's cattle. And we're going to come here and we're going to force the government to get to give it back. Now, this is the kind of the tactic that you see performed out there in Nevada with this rancher and his posse. It's the same thing that you put in mind that happened to a lot of black people who were disposed of their property where they were ran off their land and they were told, okay, you're going to get up out of here, you're going to go, and you're going to just leave with just what you have on your back. We're going to burn the courthouses down because that way you can't come back in and trace your property record if you didn't take a copy with you or you didn't keep one with you at a time. Most people didn't have that luxury. Everything was kept at courthouses. The courthouses burnt down. Well, oh, too sad, too bad. We don't, as far as we're concerned, it's not yours.
But you know, I am not aware of, with respect to the First Nations people, I'm not aware of what land dispute that they still have with the U.S. government and whether that had been settled or not. But the question still is, what, therefore, is your position? Is that the U.S. government is not entitled to levy grazing fees? Is that it?
They're not entitled because what I'm looking at, Utrecht, is like this is two criminal entities, the United States government, who is imposing grazing fees.
I get it. I understand it. But I'm saying, is it clear right now, is there a dispute between the First Nations people and the U.S. with respect to this land? Is it still contested, this particular land that the United States says is federal land? Is there an open case about it? I'm not aware.
I'm not aware of an open case, but because they have killed off all of the people, all of the inheritors for the land, they have pretty much killed them off, dispersed them throughout, and most of them probably don't even know what is theirs anymore for them to dispute. But here it is, you have a rancher that's Bundy man, sitting on this land that he said he's been on for since the 1800s.
And his forebears settled there, and they basically were accustomed to to move your herd or your cattle or whatever it is that you're raising to lands that they are accustomed to grazing on. Now that's the whole point. The federal government is saying this is federal land. It's clear that it is federal land. That's what they say. And therefore, if you are going to be grazing your cattle on this land, you should pay grazing rights.
But what I'm saying with this, Utrecht, is that
the question still is this, I mean, I understand your argument in the larger sense, but is there, and I have not been able to ascertain that, whether there is an ongoing legal case being made by the Native First Nations people, whether it is still in their minds their land. Are they still fighting this in court, or is it in fact a settled matter that the federal government is in fact the quote owners unquote of the land?
Well, Utrecht, this is something that most of us, we probably might never know, because you know, with this criminal cartel that you're dealing with, where they have killed off people, moved them around, confuse them so they don't know what is what, keep putting them on different reservations, different plots of land all over the country, so that the original inhabitants, their descendants today, probably don't even know what the heck is their property. All they just know that they've been moved around. And all the new tenants, who are predominant people coming from Europe, are coming in here, sitting on land, taking up land, and saying and passing it on to their people, and they're not going to be given any clear inheritance the property that is theirs. But yet still, these two criminal entities are fighting each other. But what I'm showing is just the bold nature of to say that, okay, we're going to take up arms and we're going to go up against the government because you're going to give me back my cattle. Oh, yeah. It's only extended to a certain group of people who feel that they can do something like that. But if anyone else, like we go out here and we protest or we do whatever we want to do, you can get shut down. They can come with the paddy wagons and everything else, as we know what happened with us in the civil rights movement, where they built concentration camps because everyone saw That documentary, Spies of Mississippi, we show what they did. They built all of these camps to house black people, and they collected off the streets just for protesting. But these people could come from all over, from all these neighboring states with their guns to have a standoff with the government.
It was a very significant development from that perspective. Number one is that the federal government is saying that they backed away simply because it would have become deadly, and it was a matter of taking prudent caution so that nobody will get hurt. After all, it was a situation that they could afford to, it was not a time-sensitive issue. They could afford to be patient. That's one thing. Number two, though, and you're quite right about that, this shows the disparity in the response. I'm thinking of MOVE, for example, in Philadelphia. I'm thinking of a number of other instances where in any other situation that the federal government would have exercised an entirely different reaction. But then we have Waco.
Yes.
And Waco showed, of course, that the federal government did move against the David Koresh.
Ruby Ridge.
And basically said that, the issue is the federal government, in the end, is the final arbiter. And they moved lots and lots of people were killed. So, yes, it's an interesting way of looking at the disparity in the way the federal government responded. But some people are still saying that it was a good thing, that they were patient and they backed off, because it really would have caused a major event, and it would not have been pretty at all. But it's still not over. This is not over yet. This is still an ongoing situation. Thanks, Sarah, for getting us started today.
You're welcome, Etrice.
Thank you. From Berkeley, Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, Etrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Very good.
Good.
Well, in the name of slowing climate destabilization, I'd like to tell you and your listeners about the pod people. These are people who sit in their parked cars, their pods, their rolling pods, with the engines running while they surf the web. They're looking at email, they're making phone calls, they're checking their Facebook account, and they sit there mesmerized, staring at their little screens, and they lose track of time. And they leave their engines running while they're doing it. And I notice this, I think this is not just a California phenomenon, but I notice it all around. I'll be walking around and I'll see these people sitting in cars, the engine's going, and they're just looking at the little screen there, and they just stay there. And so I feel that collectively there are perhaps a million people right now doing it, right now, around the planet. They're just sitting in their cars with their cars running. So, and I don't even think they're conscious that collectively they're accelerating climate destabilization. So I say that, I say to the people, shut the car down, before you sit there for a while and check out your email. And also, maybe if you get an electric car and put solar panels on your rooftop and plug your car into the sun, then it's okay. But, to add more CO2 at this time for no particular reason, and gasoline costs so much and they're just sort of wasting it. So there's millions of gallons being wasted every day by people who just sit in cars with their cars running. So I just want to, that's what I'm trying to alert you to. And,
Well, thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Thank you. 888-874-4888. What's on your mind? What stories do you think are significant enough for a review or revisiting or just the first visit even? 888-874-4888. I'm getting a bleed through somehow.
It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your...
Oh, wow. Be having a little okay, so that's fine. Okay, we're all right. 888-874-4888. We're gonna continue our program today. I was wondering whether you had any thoughts, any additional thoughts. Let me look at some of the responses that I got from going back to earlier this week when we talked about President Obama and making that speech at the National Action Network. We had that wonderful delightful exchange between Bill O'Reilly and the basketball coach for Kentucky. James from New York City, what's on your mind today?
Oh, no, it's Jay, Utrice. How are you today?
Oh, Jay. Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'd just like to say hello to my sister, Sarah. I always enjoy listening to her. I just would like to ask you a question, Utrice. Mm-hmm. What's going on in this country? And it seems like now they're trying to set up Hillary Clinton and Ted Bush to run for the presidency after this character gets out of office.
Jeb Bush.
Yeah, Jeb Bush. Where do you see this country going? Because to me, it just seems like it's not progressing in the manner that one would think it should at this day and age. I mean, I was speaking with a gentleman from Mexico that's educated. He's like a professor there. And he was saying that he does a lot of traveling because of the type of research work that he does. And he was saying that in this country, the economic equality, he's never seen it anywhere else like it is here in other countries. And he said that's the thing that mostly surprised him, you know, that, you know, we at this position now to whereas it just seems like we're not getting ahead at all, America.
And he comes from Mexico, and he doesn't see inequality as it is here?
He's an elitist. He's talking about in other countries. He's one of those elites. He's not your, how could I say it? He's like a professor
A professor is not an elite person. I mean, come on.
He's
better off than most.
There you go.
He's better off than many. But the thing is, look, why we know of Hillary Clinton is because, you know, there's a lot of money that goes into creating the awareness of Hillary Clinton. This is not just because the people want it. You know, the media, they continue this charade about all the people, they're responding to the wishes of the people. The people want to know more. No. There's a lot of money that goes into conjuring up a consciousness of anything. The media could make you remember things that you ought to forget, and it could make you forget things that you ought to remember. And there is, don't forget, in the media in many cases, it's an extension of the power elite.
Right.
So it is natural that we would have this fascination and this push for our awareness as a nation of Hillary Clinton. And, you know, they're managing it quite well. They're making it so that people will actually beg her to run, as they have, including
right.
media organizations have actually said, when is she going to run? Aren't you going to run? And this kind of nonsense. In the end, look, if she wants to run, she'll run. We'll know. How about that? We have other places all over the world where women are just taking care of business, you know, but here it's a big deal. And they build up these people to make it so that it actually almost seems logical that she would be the one as opposed to somebody else. It is a lot of money that goes into creating this awareness.
And
if you have her on one side, well, of course, they pay attention to the other side. The same process
right.
goes into making Jeb Bush or Rand Paul or whoever else a part of our consciousness. Why do we need to know about these people? Why can't we just sit down and wait until somebody decides that, yes, I'm going to run? What is all this, you know, cultivating an awareness about, oh, is she going to run? Is she going to run? Well, we'll know. How about no coverage of anybody until they decide to run? You know, until there's a news conference that says, my name is Joe Doakes and I'm running for president. And until then, we don't need to know. How about that?
Yeah, but then they couldn't sell newspapers and advertisement and
Oh, yes, it could sell newspapers and advertisements. The fact that Hillary Clinton has not made up her mind hasn't stopped the sale of newspapers or magazines or stopped people from watching TV. This is all conjured up.
Right.
You know, there's this notion that everything can, I mean, there's a process that could create an awareness of anything. If you have enough money, you can get people to love you. You can get people to hate the other guy.
Right.
You can get, it's all about money. And they've spent a lot of money. And don't forget, Hillary Clinton for 4 years had access to unending amounts of money and unending numbers of opportunities to make herself known. So there you go.
What, let me ask you before I go your opinion on what's going on in the Ukraine, because it seems to me it's kind of a contradiction that here it is, we can invade other countries, but the Russians cannot, let's say, if we want to use the word, invade a country that's right next door to them, but we go thousands of miles away to invade other countries, but
yes, of course.
Russia,
and that is
I don't understand it.
Well, neither would nobody who is operating with any degree of logic will not understand that. But this is what we see as the end result of how major powers, they all play out their problems with each other in somebody else's country. And that had happened before when Russia went to war and acquired all these little prizes. You know, you had Ukraine being one of them, but it collected all of these little countries by war and annexation. And that is what happens when, you know, the history of major powers in the world is that's what they do. We just got finished talking about an issue in Nevada that really wasn't Nevada. that is annexed land. Mexico basically extended all the way into what we now know as the so-called United States today. So all of it was done by annexation. And annexation as a result of war. That's what they do.
Right.
We will never be able to understand it because on a particular level, if you operate with a humane perspective, none of this makes sense. None of this is right. None of it. Thanks a lot, James.
Have a good day.
Sorry for your call today. Thank you. From Mount Shasta, we have Dan.
Hello, Utrece.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
Oh, I'm 65 and pacing myself.
good move.
What I'd like to free my mind on today is two ladies that aren't often are kind of undiscovered, I guess is what you would say. One of them is Lady Deborah Moody. The other is Lady Liberty. And a lot of people don't know who Lady Deborah Moody was, but she was the first woman who was given basically a territory by the Dutch up there. It's one of the boroughs, Greystone or something like that. Anyway, she was a bit of a rebel, a renegade. She had come over here from, her husband was like royalty and he died. She had all this money, so she came over here. And she, because of religious persecution, you know, she was kind of, she didn't look at things according to some of the established people at the time, so she would run around. Anyway, she was the one that basically came up with the idea of what we call the freedom of religion. And she had a lot of these ideas 90 years before, you know, the founding fathers. But anyway, she was an amazing woman. And, you know, I mean, you know, these guys, the founding fathers, you know, these guys who saw that here was this free place that truly was free, and they came up with the brainstorm idea that it needed to be managed and controlled by them.
So, well, let's go back to how you introduced Lady Moody. You remember what you said?
She was given land by
the Dutch?
Yes. Basically, the Dutch were in control of a good part of that area. The Dutch had all the fleets of vessels. They had the money. They went around and did a lot of things, the Dutch. And so they were pretty much kind of, when the colonies were being established and all that stuff, well, this was actually before the colonies. Like, this was during the founding of the areas around the boroughs, I guess New York and all that stuff.
Well, I remember the name associated in Brooklyn, Lady Moody.
Yeah.
And Lady Moody at the time, people celebrate Lady Moody, but this is not yet another instance again of people appropriating land that is not theirs.
Right.
And she had no problem saying, yes, I'm a colonial entity. And
exactly.
Basically given land to establish herself as a kind of landlady, a huge landlady, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
I mean, on the one hand, I mean, your reference today is about Lady Moody being akin to the founding fathers, but fathers or founding mothers, if you will, in the case of Lady Moody, the fact is that they came to a country already settled, already populated, and just waged war against people and said, look, I'm here, they didn't come to build schools and hospitals and better roads. They came to take whatever they could from whoever had it.
Well, that's what
Lady Moody is not so much of a lady in my view. The Lady Moody was also part of that process of saying, I am taking what I want. And the Dutch, the Dutch, again, another imperial power. The Dutch had a lot of, the Dutch East India Company, for example.
Oh, yeah.
The Dutch in the Caribbean to this day.
Yeah.
You take a little island, for example, like St. Martin. A little island, about 34 square miles or so. And yet divided by two imperial powers.
Right.
There is literally an international border. It's actually a little teeny tiny bridge, but it is theoretically an international border in an island 34 square miles in area, where you have on one side the Dutch controlling one side and the other side the French. And there's nobody there. The basic St. Martin, or born and raised in St. Martin, is a tourist in his own country.
Yeah.
So you have this phenomenon. So when we talk about Lady Moody, let's keep in mind that Lady Moody was the female version of the males who came here to dominate and take whatever it is they wanted.
I couldn't agree more. The only reason that I brought her up wasn't that she was some guideline by her politics or position or her land grabbing. It was the point that she had a certain political posture which basically established the freedom of religion. She really brought that home. That was what she was founded. It was that idea, because it's like 90 years later, the founding fathers come up with this brilliant idea. And it wasn't them. I mean, we could track it back before Lady Moody to the Iroquois. You know, these weren't ideas that these guys figured out. They were ideas that had already been thought out. They took those and they utilized as a way of taking control over freedom, so that freedom was managed.
But isn't that, when you look at it, all these wonderful religious people These God-fearing people had no problem exterminating the folks who were in their way, as they saw it, from achieving their goals. And then they, with God on their side, they again decided who ought to have these rights of freedom, of religion.
Exactly.
It's an amazing thing when you look at it, really.
Yeah,
history is replete with
these
kinds of contradictions.
Absolutely. It was pretty much built on fraud. But just to hit on something, on the second thing was Lady Liberty. You know, it's kind of been an idea of mine that the United States had a wonderful opportunity in our early years. And when the French were originally preparing to sculpt, decided to give to America this gift of the Statue of Liberty as a kind of a monument of what they thought about America in this newfound thing, that the original sculpting was of a black woman.
That's
and
correct.
A white, yes, and a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people find that abusive. And what I find abusive is that they didn't leave it that way. But anyway, her right hand, instead of holding a scroll or whatever, had a shackle on it with a broken chain, and her left foot had and still does have a chain coming out, a shackle on her left. So they were giving this as a monument that America had broken rank, had freed the slaves, and that black women, that it was that freedom given to black, that black women were the ones that were really freed, because they were kind of the bottom of the pecking, you know. So the idea that that was offensive to anyone, I think that if the Statue of Liberty was a black woman and her left arm had a shackle with a chain, I think it'd be something that we could take pride in if we could live up to that.
Well, anyway, it takes a lot of maturity to accept that. It really does, and the nation isn't quite there yet. Thanks, Dan, for calling.
Thank you.
Good talking with you today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello,
you
sir.
Doing?
How do you do?
I'm doing fine. I hope everyone out there is well and feeling inspired.
Hot.
Excuse me?
And feeling hot.
And feeling hot. I wanted to talk about something that didn't get a lot of coverage, almost none, in fact, even on progressive stations, which really dismayed me. A wonderful gentleman passed away just this past Sunday. He is one of your fellow hosts there at PRN,
Michael Rupert,
yeah.
Rupert,
yeah. He took his own life on Sunday.
And yes.
I believe he was one of those people that was just so frustrated with the way things are and how we are pretty much helpless unless people wake up and join the fight. And I believe ultimately the man was very tortured. You know, he actually shot himself, as you probably know, right after his show on Sunday.
Yes.
And it's pretty sad. I mean, I followed him for a long time, ever since I first saw, and I was looking at this again last night, the tape of him, I believe it's 1991 or something like that, where he's at this, it was carried on C-SPAN, it was a meeting to try and figure out how these drugs are getting into Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was at that time a former LAPD investigator and police officer. And he stood there, and he had the courage to confront the
CIA director at the time.
I mean, the CIA director, yeah, Mr. Mm-hmm. Deutsch, head on, and told him that he had evidence that the CIA was bringing drugs into Los Angeles and all over this country for a long time. And he said that he had gotten shot at, and they tried to kill him. And, you know, once I saw that years ago, I started following this man because he's one of those people that he sees he saw an injustice, and he said, this is wrong, and I'm going to do something about it. And that to me, you know, he sacrificed a lot. And I just wanted to pay tribute to him and say that, oh, by the way, that director, Deutsch of the CIA, 1 month later resigned. And you look at, I want people to go to YouTube and look up the video. Just put Michael Rupert, R-U-P-P-E-R-T, CIA drugs. And you can see all the while this director, Deutsch, looks like he's on a hot seat. He's fidgeting around and he's fiddling with his fingers and his hands. And he looks so nervous. So a month later, because he knew Michael Rupert was telling the truth, and a month later this guy resigned.
Well, you know, first of all, I am going to do something next week. I was told just yesterday, I did not know that, I did not know of his death at all until a colleague at PRN told me about it. But I first heard about him, of course, in exactly the same case you just mentioned about the connection, the CIA drugs connection, and I mean, it was a big story at WBAI at the time, and you know, his tapes were very, very important in that era. And of course, he went on as a former LAPD detective. He did a number of other very important investigative pieces, and exposed the nasty underside of a lot of what we are presented with today. The major disaster. He, in fact, I just sent a note to someone about it. Peak oil was one of his issues. Oil,
right,
and
exactly.
Not just oil itself, but the U.S. machinations involving even warfare and global destabilization in the name of oil. Mm-hmm.
And he has a documentary called Collapse as well that people can look up. And it's a very intriguing documentary. I love that. He also, one of his issues was the war, the 9/11 too. That was one
9/11,
of his
in which he specifically said, he specifically charged
Dick Cheney
with coordinating this fake series of fake blips and a very sophisticated program of deception. This was something that I was hoping to present next week, learning just yesterday of his death. I did not know before yesterday. But certainly, I have been following him for quite a while myself, but it goes all the way back to the days of the Los Angeles CIA drug connection when, of course, people were laughing and saying, come on, you know, here's another conspiracy theory that they're bringing drugs into the black neighborhoods. Sure, the government is doing something that crazy. And it turns out, yes, the government was doing something that crazy.
Exactly. And, you know, that CIA director was on tap to be, he was tapped by Bill Clinton and promised that he was going to be Secretary of Defense. He lost that because of Michael Rupert outing this, and which is a good thing. But this guy was total, and is probably still, total complete scum. He was a liar. So I just wanted to pay tribute to Michael Rupert. May he rest in peace. And
thank you for sharing that. I was going to do that next week. But thank you. That was very, very nice of you to remember him and to certainly remember his work.
Okay, thank
you. He did quite a bit of work to the benefit of society as a whole. And yes, I learned yesterday. I'm sure that I was slower than most everybody to know, but I did learn about it yesterday. It was very, it affected me a great deal. He did a lot of work. Good work, and was very genuine about the work that he did. And in a way, that's the greatest testimonial to a person. You judge by the contribution that they've made to the welfare of the people as a whole. And of course, part of the story here too is the torture, self-torture. He was a very tortured person. Tortured by what he saw as the impending and looming collapse of the world under the greed and the really awful decisions that governments make, deliberate efforts to satisfy an unending thirst for domination and greed. It's just unbelievable. Some people take these things very, very much to heart, and he was one of them. And he did not see that it was going to get better. He didn't see that he was doing all that he could do, and yet he actually did all he could do. But he was very, very troubled about that. There's another part of it, too, and it speaks to our mental health. You know, every day we deal with issues that sometimes we don't think about it right away, but they do have a cumulative effect of, I guess, deadening the soul. It discourages, and it mounts up after a while, and you feel hopeless about not just about your situation, but about the whole humanity. Where is it all going? Where are we going to end up? A lot of people can't cope with this question. It's so enormous. It seems so overwhelming. It's like watching a disaster happening in very slow motion, and you know what the end is going to look like, but you feel also helpless to stop it. So many people, I think, and this is my strange little theory, I think a lot of the mental destabilization that we experience has to do with a sense of hopelessness that we get from just observing what is happening around us as a government. What is government doing? And what is my relationship to this machine that won't listen to me, that won't do the right thing? It just will not do the right thing. That won't see to everybody's needs, that won't fairly distribute the resources, that won't act in the interest of justice. These are enormous weights on a lot of people's minds, as we see. You know, we just go around our business every day, but it is internalized. And sometimes, you know, it just rushes up like a tsunami, and it overwhelms, and people are paralyzed by it. They feel empty. They feel so completely useless and inadequate in the face of all of these challenges that seem insurmountable because they are so carefully put together with evil intent. And people devote a lot of time and energy and resources to doing really awful things. And sometimes you just can't wrap your mind around this. And you wonder, I mean, if I can't solve not even one-tenth of this stuff, what is my life worth? If you value your life as being of service to others, you feel that you're not doing nearly enough. And for some people, they just can't cope with that. And I believe he was one of them. I believe he wanted to do so much to advance society as a whole. But you have that sense of foreboding. You know, I wonder, you know, people like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X and individuals who put themselves completely at service to people and to the nation as a whole. There's a psychology there that I think ought to be understood. I don't know that we know even half of what we ought to know about people like that, the struggles, the mental struggles that they have in dealing with the enormity of the thing that they are tackling, the thing that they are attacking, the thing they're trying to fix, and the impediments, because human beings are just not built that way. They don't share the same vision. They don't have the same perspective. It's a very lonely thing. So we will remember him next week, I'm sure. We will do that. So thank you so much for joining us today and sharing with all of us your thoughts and considered opinions. Thank you so much. Have yourselves a great weekend. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. And thank you for your continued support of PRN It's a great outlet, and we have to take good care of it and make sure that it's in the position to help us communicate with each other. Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Feeling hot, hot, hot. How you feeling? Hot, hot.